Thanks to Blumador for once again sponsoring this week's episode. Blumador has set the standard for enterprise-grade IT monitoring. They seamlessly stream metrics and logs from all kinds of different sources right into your favorite monitoring platform. So, of course, you have tons of metrics and logs and monitoring agents and all these different data sources kind of feeding into your different dashboards, but the data sets can be siloed off from each other, and it can be difficult to kind of connect the dots and see how things are interacting. And of course, you have to configure all the different monitoring agents on different platforms and OSs, and it's just a real pain in the butt. So Blumador's solution to this is called Bindplane. They've taken metrics and logs from over 150 different technologies. They can be on-premises, hybrid cloud, or multi-cloud stacks. And it'll feed them all right into the favorite monitoring tool that you already use. Things like Google Stack Driver, New Relic, Azure Monitor, Wavefront, and Datadog. It allows you to see how the components of your stack are interacting in real time, and you can draw relationships between all those different metrics that previously had been siloed off from one another. The end result is a single view into the performance of your entire stack. You don't have to spend time configuring monitoring agents or developing your own custom integrations. It also gives you a real dimensionality to your metrics, allowing you to dig down and pinpoint performance problems before they become a real problem. So it's free to install and upgrade Google Stack Driver with Blumador integration if you use that. So if you head on over to blumador.com/compute, you can install their free update and you'll get a $200 credit towards Google Cloud Platform, which can even be combined with other Google free trial credits. That's really, really great. Turn your information into insight with Blumador.
All right, welcome back, everybody. We're at our, I think this is our last show for Ignite 2019.
That we know of?
That we're aware of. I'm not opposed to doing more shows, but yeah, so we're here with Stefan Schakow, who is Principal Program Manager of the App Platform for Microsoft Azure.
Did we get it all?
Yeah, good enough. Basically, I work on App Service.
Gotcha.
Anything and everything involving Azure App Service.
So what are App Services in a nutshell?
Yeah, so in a nutshell, it's an easy way to run web apps and API apps that are web apps at scale in the cloud on a platform as a service platform. We will take any apps that run on Windows or Linux, so we support both operating systems. Simplest way to think of it is that if you've been doing a lot of development on either IIS or like on Linux with Apache and Nginx, imagine that we really abstracted those and made them work at scale up in the cloud, and we're the service that does that.
So we're familiar with services like Heroku, and I use Cloud 66. They kind of orchestrate all the pieces for you so that you basically just point it at GitHub and push your code, and it just does everything. That's
correct.
It's along those same lines.
Yep, exactly. It's the same general things, exactly like you said. We got great integration with GitHub, local Git, you name it. Built-in native support, exactly, where you can go push to a repo. We'll automatically pull it, build it, and then go ahead and light it up and start running. And actually, I got a session tomorrow where I'll start showing some of the early work we've been doing actually with GitHub Actions,
okay, which
is pretty cool because the GitHub folks, right, they have their Actions platform that spans basically anyone that integrates with them. And that's actually cool because it makes the whole, you know, pull the repo build process actually very native to the GitHub side of the house. And then again, whatever the build artifact is, you can just throw it over the wall to us and then
we'll go run
it.
Saves you some re-implementation work, basically.
Yeah, it's really what it comes down to is if you peel back the covers and look at a lot of the things that are kicking around in App Service, one of the myriad things it can do is it can build your source code. So that's both a good thing, but it's also over time you end up with like 23 different frameworks and variations of how to build stuff. And so what's actually nice about it is, case in point, in the Microsoft world, we have good integration with Azure Pipelines and then let them go out and do the build. And what's nice is to have an open source alternative that does a similar thing, is able to orchestrate a flow of steps, do the builds for all the myriad frameworks that folks use out on GitHub, and then again, just sort of use us as the platform to go out and run and scale.
Gotcha.
So I was actually playing with this last night. I have a Rails app, and so I was just kind of want to go through the steps and just see what it was like to get it set up. I didn't complete it because there's a lot of moving pieces there, but at least did get the code pushed there, and I guess it uses Kudu for doing the build. That's kind of like the classic way it's done it.
Yeah, it's that's sort of the code name. Actually, the implementation has changed a lot. Underneath the hood, there's Kudu for Windows, there's Kudu for Linux. The original Kudu is on the Windows side and was actually all built in-house by various engineers on App Service to do the intrinsic build steps and actually do the hookups to things like GitHub. What's interesting is the implementation that's out there for Linux is a collaboration with a lot of folks who work over in Visual Studio and what we call developer division, because they have a lot more experts who actually understand the nuances of what this is, what a Python build really means, okay, what a node build really means. So underneath the hood, you still see it as Kudu, sort of the way you hook up the different loosely connected pieces sort of flows through that Kudu part. But underneath the hood, the actual build magic is something that we get from the Visual Studio folks. And then again, with what's going on with GitHub Actions, now that's another example of yet another community, another group of engineers, where they can, again, introduce their own way of this is how you do like build and test of a node app.
Right.
And then again, for us, it's actually good because we can sort of fade a little bit into the background, just say, okay, once you've done everything you needed to sort of build your stuff, just give it to us and then let us run it.
Yeah, let people figure out how they like to handle it, and then
yes,
let them give you the piece that you actually need to work.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things is, of course, right, we saw this with pipelines. You even see it in a lot of the docs, and what folks do with Kudu today is there are a million different customizations folks want to do. This is what I want to do before you do the build. This is explicitly how I want you to do the build. These are the post-build test steps,
right.
You name it. And the reality is, right, there's a lot of different pieces of functionality folks want. There are a million different ways they do it, and that's why for us it's actually, it's nice to have something built in so you can get going, but it's also nice to be able to step back and say, hey, as you want richer systems, like go with GitHub Actions, go with Azure Pipelines, and go use those ecosystems.
And if you want to manage, so this is primarily for your application code, your sort of compute code, and what if you have other services like maybe databases or caches or any kind of third-party other stuff that you have to manage, how is that built into there as well, or is that kind of managed separately?
Yeah, so that is a great question, and right, I mean, the reality is, right, the joke is what, no app is an island. It's sort of funny, on a sort of related segue, when folks talk to us about like, hey, I want to migrate an app, usually my first question has nothing to do with the app. It says, I like to joke, right, the old school television sets, like before televisions were like 1 inch wide, but now back when they were like 10 feet deep,
right,
you know,
yeah,
you have all this stuff that's exploding out the back of it that's got to connect to actually work, right? It's the same deal with an app, right? It's got all these back-end tendrils that go hither and yon for the app to actually work. So back to your question, you're right. We, an app service, like, you know, we're not the platform for running a Redis cache or a Postgres database. From our point of view, we're pretty agnostic. We make it easy for you to say, hey, how do I actually connect to the thing? So, right, you can do the obvious thing, store a connection string. We store it securely at rest, et cetera, et cetera. But it's a couple of different things. It's up to customers to either, like, run a service variation of those, right? So there's like a fully managed Redis cache service as an example. By the same token, you can go ahead and like go run Redis cache yourself, stick it on a bunch of virtual machines, point us at it, and then that admittedly gets into the depths and the vagaries of, you know, what's a virtual network, because then in many cases, especially for databases, it's completely understandable. A lot of customers will either never move their data tiers, or that will be the thing that moves the slowest in terms of ever coming up to the cloud. And so obviously the way you get from here to there is with a virtual network that connects your assets up in Azure all the way back to what's on-prem. And again, there's, you know, I know enough to be highly dangerous when I talk about networking. There's luckily network engineers and Azure networking folks who can talk our ears off about all the vagaries of how to do that. But ultimately, that's where you land. You can run an app or a whole bunch of apps up in the cloud on app service, and you can still tunnel back to, you know, your older Sybase or Oracle or SQL servers that are still running on hardware on-prem.
Yeah, that's what's been such a eye-opening experience for me, because I don't have any, like, I was making a joke earlier, somebody was giving a presentation about legacy systems, and I was talking about my legacy systems being code modules I haven't touched in a while, right? And they're talking about a robot to help you connect to that, and I was like, I need that, you know, I need a refactor robot. But it's so, such a different plant, like, I'm not anywhere near to any of this stuff. We were just talking to a guy who works for it sounded like he actually runs like the IT part of a wine making company that's kind of like all over the West Coast.
Okay.
And he was talking about how they have, you know, all of these on-premises servers, but that also they're trying to get cold storage into the cloud and like trying to manage how to do it automatically. But he was saying that if a server goes down, it takes them 3 or 4 days to rebuild it because they don't do snapshots because they haven't figured out how to put it all together. And I'm thinking to myself, like, I don't know. I like get push and Heroku does something, and then like 5 minutes later, people are clicking on the new code, you know?
Yeah. That's, I mean, if you take database tier as an example, right, when people say, like, okay, why should I run anything as a service? Actually, your example is perfect, because I remember, again, eons ago, and in the various things I've done in the software world, right, spent some time being a DBA are doing SQL stuff like a lot of other folks. And man, yeah, right, that's always the what version of the database software, and then like, oh, are you running on hardware that's actually been approved by the vendor? And I sure remember once upon a couple of eons ago, you actually had to, of all things, it was like SCO Linux. You had to actually go out and recompile the Linux kernel to work with, like, it was like an Informix database. So, you know, those kinds of things, right, in a highly managed service like SQL DB or Postgres or MySQL, whether it's us or other folks, right, the biggest value is that's not your problem anymore, right? Go deploy your database underneath the hood, case in point, in Azure, right? They've got hordes of people who built a highly resilient infrastructure underneath the hood. So if one disk dies, it's okay. Like, you don't even know what happens.
Yeah.
Like, it would require like an alien invasion from Mars before you would actually have to start worrying about like, I wonder if my database will still be up and running. At that point, you probably have more important things to worry about.
And that's sort of what I always tell people too. Like, I've mentioned a few times the example, like I'm talking to Rockwell and I check my phone, I have two emails. The first one's, oh, your database needs repair. Second one's, it's been repaired, you're all good. You know, and I had no idea that any of it ever happened.
Yep. Yeah, exactly. And that's, I mean, and then winding it back a bit to app service, right? Granted, we don't have as, shall we say, difficult, you know, problems in terms of DR, right? Because obviously with databases, it literally gets to the point that every bit and byte counts. Mm-hmm. But I mean, for us, right, that's one of the things we take care of, right? You don't have to worry about a VM dying. Like, case in point, that happens occasionally underneath the hood. We detect that. We'll automatically, in essence, what's called service heal the platform, roll your app onto a new VM, a new piece of hardware. Things keep on running. You know, maybe in your monitoring software, you saw a hiccup for 30 seconds. That's it. Done. Yeah. Right? You don't suddenly sit there going like, oh man, it's 3 a.m. in the morning. Apparently what I'm going to be doing before breakfast is building a new server. It's like that. Like, that's passe. You don't have to deal with that anymore.
That's the guy I work with, Lee, he before they moved all their stuff to the cloud. Like, they had two colos, one in Oakland and one in Boston.
Yep.
And I was in California at the time, so he flew out, and I met him there. And so we go in, we go to the colo, we go through security, we go into the cage, he unlocks the cage, he takes out the dead drive from the RAID array, he pops in the RAID array, he's like, okay, I'm going back to Boston.
I remember, like, again, from jobs in the past, there was something where, right, the HVAC died in the building.
Oh.
And of course, right, this is back in the day when you still had your server room was like down the hallway. And man, of course, right, half the servers were dead. You open up the door and it's like opening up an oven, like this heat wave comes boiling out. And I mean, right, that was like a multi-day outage while they're sitting there trying to see what got fried, what didn't, bring it back up. Again, thankfully, right, you know, hopefully that doesn't happen at all in Azure. And again, from your point of view, it's like, okay, well, if something died on a rack over there, well, it just goes switch you over to another building. From your point of view, again, you don't even know that's happening. It just, like, things just get automatically healed and taken care of.
Well, what was it? A few months ago, we were at ElixirConf, and it was at a pretty, I think it was like a brand new sort of lodge thing. And the first night, they had a big power outage. And at some point, the server room lit on fire. And,
well, marshmallows, bring them out.
Yeah, exactly. So they were having problems all weekend with stuff like that, the power going out. And then, so we wake up in the morning and people were talking to us like, did you get evacuated last night? I was like, what are you talking about? They're like, the hotel was on fire. And, like, I was sleeping in my bed all night.
Yeah. I mean, one interesting thing that brings up, though, is that although, right, I mean, the cloud's great for a lot of things, there is one small sort of Achilles heel, of course, which is if someone comes up with a pair of scissors and snips your network cord, the cloud doesn't exist anymore at that point from your point of view. So, I mean, that is something on a more serious note, regardless of whether you're talking about app tier, data tier, you name it, actually having a very good understanding of what subset of your workloads actually do need to work disconnected, do need to work if the power goes out. I mean, case in point, right? If I work for the power company, there's probably a suite of apps that are riding out there on trucks or when they come back that literally does need to work when the power is out because that's their job, right? So that's sort of the other end of the spectrum. Although, again, right, I mean, I love being in Azure. What it's opened up for everyone development-wise is amazing, but to rein things in a bit, you still have to have that pragmatism to say, hey, guess what? Disasters do happen. What part of your business is potentially impacted? Are you actually able to handle that?
Yeah. That description of it makes the discussion I had earlier with the winery person makes so much more sense because he's talking about, he called it the hybrid stack, I think it was, the Azure hybrid stack. So, like, having these services running on-prem, but having them automatically sort of connect to the cloud for running backups and syncing transparently, basically. So that makes way more sense now. And even on the software world, because that's where most that's where we live mostly, really. I don't know, maybe last year someone was tweeting. I don't remember exactly who it was, so I won't say. But they were tweeting about different things that they were wanting to work on. So they went down to the fire department or the EMT service and said, what can we do with software to help you out? And one thing they said was like, well, sometimes we go into places and we need to enter data and we don't have good cell service. And so an obvious solution there is to have maybe like a progressive web app that would work offline and then sync data once they
right.
get service.
Yep. Yeah. And that, right. I mean, that's probably stating the obvious, but right. Data sync, the ability to run things on devices, whatever your iPad, your laptops, your surfaces, being able to sync the data back to a central location. And then of course, from the point of view of the front end, the rest of the apps, realizing that, look, some set of your data, it's not necessarily going to be the most up to date all the time.
Yeah.
Right. So being able to handle the logical problems of data may be out of sync, it may be a day or two out of date, things like that, but still being able to, you know, run the business on what you do have.
Yeah.
You know, classic example would be like hotels, right? You know, you still want to be able to check people in, even though you might have lost connectivity back to a back end system. So what's the worst that happens? You should at least be able to like check people in and out at the local facility. You might not be able to take a reservation for a month from now because maybe you don't have the view of of that data going down the road, but you're still able to do the day to day operations, sort of keep on chugging along.
Or even payments too. There, when I was living in Vermont, the deli there would happen and they were having all sorts of problems with their card machine. So I'd go in, get a sandwich. I don't have cash. They can't take my card. They'll tell me like, come back later or tomorrow.
Right. Yeah.
You know, I like to think I'm a good person. So I go back and pay for it, but also I lived in a small town and they would see me.
Right.
You know,
didn't know that.
But
yeah, that actually brings up an interesting point, right? Cause again, like a lot of you, right. I've got my card on my smartphone, right. You know, sort of lazy, just use it to go pay for stuff.
Yeah.
But yeah, right. I mean, what happens if the internet's down? I mean, right. Especially if I'm in Seattle, okay. I don't know who you are. You don't know who I am. Right. It's not going to be particularly useful to say hey, well, you know, you can trust me. Right. So again, it's an example where take advantage of the technology when you've got it, but realize there's going to be that 5% of the time where, hey, guess what? We live in the real world. Things happen. What's your backup? However primitive it is, so you can actually still continue to transact business in life, right?
And for me specifically, I'm in California, and PG&E's been shutting my power off. You know,
that's true.
Places are burning, and they shut the fire off, so they don't cause more. And so that was a very real thing. And maybe work shouldn't be as important as I'm like, okay, how can I keep working if the power's out? But really, it's other stuff like, do I have a cooler for my food?
Right. Is your refrigerator running? I mean, the classic thing, if I'm in a hospital, right, you need to refrigerate a certain amount of the medicine, the antibiotics, things like that. So yeah, I mean that's why, like, I've certainly been around long enough, bumped into customers where we have these discussions, and at least you have some degree of sort of pragmatism and reality around, like, hey, you can run a lot of things in the cloud, but there's a lot that still has to run off of a battery without an internet connection, so that you can actually still, like I said, transact your business, carry out your day-to-day life while things come back online.
Yeah.
Either that or you bring along a solar-powered backpack.
So, that's
funny you mention that.
He's
funny
got one. Excellent.
That. I don't have it with me, but I have so my MacBook Pro requires approximately 87 watts to charge if it's not at 100%. So I have a battery that can do that. And then I have a solar panel that I can slap on my bike if I want to. Charges the battery, that charges my laptop, right? So.
All right.
Yeah.
All right.
It's a thing.
There you go. You have a personal multi-tiered disaster recovery strategy.
That's right.
No, you have a business continuity strategy for
That's
you.
That's right. Yeah, yeah.
I like it.
As long as the cell towers are up. If the cell towers go down, I'm screwed, but.
Yeah. Well, and then we're moving over to 5G, and then we'll get even more roped in and dependent upon all that cellular service. And then,
Skylink, right? It's coming, Musk's satellite
Starlink.
Thing.
Starlink. Yeah.
Starlink.
Yeah, what is it? So it's 2019. One wonders how, you know, like 1919, 100 years ago, probably electricity was still sort of a new thing.
Yeah.
150 years ago, it's like, hey, here's a candle.
Yeah.
And now we're like, oh my God, I don't have my cell phone service. How am I going to get my Uber? It's like, dude, here's a horse.
That's like it's probably what they were thinking after they got the telegraph system, right? It's like now you can get news instantly, and then
Then someone cuts the telegraph line. They're like, "What the? You know, get that back up." Then they learn how to dig ditches and stick the telegraph line in it, so you couldn't do that.
It's like that that Louis C.K. thing where he's on Conan or whatever. He's like, people are so quick to like you're on an airplane and the Wi-Fi breaks.
Oh, right. Like, oh, everyone's God, like, dang oh it. Yeah, and you don't realize, like, dude, you're on an airplane.
Yeah.
you're crossing from coast to coast in 5 hours. It used to take like 5 months.
You're on a chair in the sky. Yeah. So we're both developers, and we don't have bosses. Like we don't. Well, it's just
good kind for
of.
You.
In terms of making design decisions about our software, like we kind of have to take in the requirements from customers and decide what's important and how to implement and roadmaps and all that stuff. Right. It's challenging, and like app services is this big thing that like means a lot of things to a lot of people, and you've got to. It's a really general purpose, right? I mean, yes, it's literally just running code. Yep. So how do you decide? I mean, app service, obviously, I haven't used it before. I don't know how it's grown in the new features, but like, how do you even decide? How do you take in requirements from people and decide like what's going to come next for it?
Right. So completely jokingly, we, of course, have a very robust planning cycle.
Absolutely.
In which we fill out a 14-page report every 30 days, and then run through a bunch of mediated user groups, and then we aggregate. No, okay, don't worry.
That sounds like Microsoft,
yeah,
right?
Yeah, exactly. And then that's version 2019, part 1, Mark 3, mod 4 of the process, which we'll be updating tomorrow after we've taken in the engineering change order. No. It's not that bad. Let me put it this way. Early days, when the thing started, we were definitely more on the Wild West end of the spectrum. I have to admit, a number of us, myself included, when this project first started eons ago, we were sort of like, man, is this thing even going to fly? And it's crazy things like, hey, yeah, we're just going to go ahead and like throw a bunch of servers up there on this thing called Azure, which back then for us, we were just like, what, Azure? It's like some dudes in this building over there, right? So we're like, okay, well, you know, sure, we'll go ahead and try to run it on that, but, you know, that's probably crazy talk. And then, you know, okay, well, I got to go run a web app. So then it's like, okay, well, let's go ahead and figure out how in the heck do you, like, run a web app when I don't have the machine underneath my desk, right? So when you're at that point, the decisions are pretty easy because it's like, okay, you have some very obvious things you're trying to solve. You start bootstrapping it. You start seeing it come together pretty quickly. So that's right, like going from zero to something, zero to 30 miles per hour, right? Then the next phase itself was still, in terms of figuring out what you're going to do, still sort of makes sense because you get to things like, hey, it'd be really cool if you have SSL. It's like, ooh, okay. That sounds like a great idea. Let's figure out how to do that, which turns out to be a bit more of a pain than you would think when it's like, hey, you have 1,000 different customers running on an underlying scale unit and you have no idea who cert is what. You got to go ahead and get all the bindings and everything else right. So that takes a certain amount of time to get what these days looks like. Well, yeah, duh, of course, right? Why wouldn't I give you a cert? But to actually put that together turns out to be like, welcome to distributed computing hell. So you put that together, and now to your point, right, we've been around long enough, the business has grown to be like it's pretty darn big, and what you said earlier is actually great. We are basically a general purpose PaaS service, right? We are intentionally not opinionated. Right, like if you don't actually have a specific requirement or philosophy on thou shalt build your app this way, we're actually a great platform. It's like, dude, if you can run your code, like, there you go. You know, you're off to the races. So at this point, things get a lot more nuanced. In terms of how we figure out, like, sort of what should we or shouldn't we go after, part of it in all seriousness is literally like this conference, the Ignite 2019 conference. Myself, a bunch of other folks, both from the program manager team and from the engineering teams, like, we've got presentations. We're typically at the booth for the vast majority of our time here in Florida. So, I mean, at this point, I couldn't even tell you how many customers I've talked to, but you just, when you have enough folks coming by and talking, asking questions, bouncing ideas off of you, you sort of see the trend of like what's on their mind, what are they looking at. So that's a great way of just getting like real feedback from, again, from the real folks who are either using us or considering whether or not they should use us. So that's one incredibly critical touch point for us. And then for us, again, we're lucky in the sense that, again, because big company, Microsoft, huge field organization, a lot of partners, a lot of sales personnel, you name it, there's no shortage pretty much every day, every week of, you know, either getting on con calls, team chats, emails, sometimes face-to-face meetings, again, with customers or their account teams where they're asking, like, how could I go ahead and implement this solution? Or I've got a problem, I ran into this brick wall. And so from that point of view, there's no lack of feedback. The challenge, which probably, again, for you guys is pretty familiar, a million great things we could do, a very, very, very finite number of resources that we can actually go after it. So, again, that's also something where sometimes if I get a customer like, hey, why didn't you implement X? Like, actually, it's not because we don't agree with you. It's just like a million great ideas, not a million engineers, right? If I could press a button and implement some things that I've wanted for years, like, I'd do it. So that's the thing. You sort of get the funnel in. And then from there, it's, look, if it's for example, causing support problems, if it's causing reliability, uptime problems, those are the, hey, my house is on fire problem, we got to go address it. So that at least is like easy from a prioritization standpoint. And then with everything else, it's a matter of really like, are there enough customers in quantity who keep on bringing up the same problem over and over again? To give you, you know, a pretty straightforward example, for quite a few years in the service, coming back to the old discussion about virtual networks, we had no real way to connect to it. And we were sort of like, okay, does this really matter or not? And what happened is that we kept on getting folks literally coming up to us. Back then it was TechEd and eventually Ignites, saying, hi, I'm from bank XYZ. We tried out your service. We love it. There's no way in heck we're ever going to use you because there's no way to safely connect to our stuff. Right. We're like, gee, it would probably be a good idea to be able to do business with the banking industry. Maybe we should go fix that. So it's a sort of pretty obvious example, but it's a thing where like we're still like, yeah, it's going to be difficult. Do we really need to? Is it a thing? And nowadays, of course, you look at me like, well, yeah, duh, right? I mean, of course, sure, it's a thing. But back then, it wasn't the most obvious thing. It's sort of like, it's just sort of esoteric or exotic. But then it's like, okay, we actually like, we need to do something about it. And once we did that, that unlocked a heck of a lot of business.
Right.
So that sort of gives you an idea of sort of everything from formal to, frankly, a lot more informal, customer-driven, you know, I dare you say, like social media in terms of whether it's forums, tweets, things like that. I'm just like, hey, what's important?
That's funny. So what you basically described is like every software project ever.
Yeah,
it's no different. Yeah,
exactly. It's, you know, where the things get sort of maybe on the other end of the stodgy spectrum with a lot of processes. Again, Azure is a million different teams. And so, again, I am lucky enough I'm on a team where things still can be much more connected to, hey, what are we actually hearing from customers? But on the other hand, I can't, again, if I use Azure Networking as an example, I can't turn around and, like, bombard them with 50 random ideas,
right?
Especially because, like, folks who do networking, the low-level compute, storage, you name it, in Azure, they have the very difficult and sometimes unenviable job of they have to build this substrate for literally the cloud on the entire planet.
Right.
And so they do actually need things sort of prioritized in a much more rational fashion, because in many cases what they're looking for is, hey, App Service says they need this specific networking feature. And then they'll be like, oh, you know, hey, what is AKS? Are they asking about it? For the folks who manage raw VMs, is that a scenario? Things like that. So when you get to that end of the spectrum where we have to sort of like rejigger the foundations of the house, as it were, that is a case where, yeah, we do a lot of running around, talking to other teams, saying, okay, it just sounds like we're asking for the same thing. If we can all sort of tweak some of the asks so that it's sort of a consistent set of asks, okay, now we can sit down with basically the architects who are building the foundations, as it were, of Azure and make a consistent ask where they're like, okay, I know how to build, I can build you one thing that's super important. What I can't do is I can't build you 15 different things. And then again, like, so it's a bit of give and take where it's like, okay, maybe there's work on our end to sort of adjust to it, but that way they can solve 95% of the problem, we can do the other 5%, and what they build helps us, and again, AKS, and Service Fabric, and VMs, and everything else. And so for there, you know, granted, you can't just, from a pragmatic standpoint, you can't run that like the Wild West. You do actually need to have, right, a degree of process to keep everything on an even keel.
Well, even on a scale like what I'm dealing with, you know, so we have 7 people, I'm the only programmer, what you're describing is really hitting home with me too, because it's really difficult for me to fight that sort of Wild West, that's the speed at which they're throwing things at me. And it's hard for me because everyone is equally as busy as the other person to say, here's a process, I need you to follow it, because they might be at a store with a customer and they're just trying to get information. They're just trying to remember everything the customer is saying. And for me, it's a fire hose. I'm like, whoa, I can't, I'm building a feature and I'm having to stop, listen to you about a different feature.
Yep,
and it
yep.
has, you know, and like you said, one thing I try really hard to remember is we have one core customer. We don't have 100 different core customers,
yep.
you know,
yep.
and that's been a huge battle for me to sort of deal with. And this is my first, like, the biggest team I've ever worked on was 3 people, including me, right? So 2 other programmers. So this is like the first time where I'm actually like having to make these calls and like think about these processes and trying to not be the bad guy, but say like, hey, you can't.
Yep, yep.
bring things to me in this fashion. It has to be this way.
Yeah. So, I mean, another thing is, and it's sort of relevant to the discussion we had earlier about Kudu, right? Part of it that even we go through in our team is we're moving away from a place where we try to do everything to literally seeing, if you want to think about it, quote unquote, outsourcing some of the functionality. And so again, if we come back to things like GitHub Actions and Azure Pipelines, that's a perfect example where on day one for our service, we want people to just be able to come into the service and use it. And if I suddenly tell you, oh yeah, by the way, go learn these other things, do this other stuff, like, right, did people lose their minds? But now it actually makes a lot more sense to, again, metaphorically outsource the expertise, the compute horsepower, the options that's involved in a build system and say, hey, you know something? I can't do 200 different things simultaneously, but these folks over in GitHub know how to do it for their community, and these folks over here in Azure DevOps and Azure Pipelines know how to do it for their community. Why don't I build the, you know, dare I say it, loosely connected, loosely coupled service interfaces, as it were, and then they do what they do really well. We make it really simple to throw the stuff over the wall to us. We do what we know how to do, which is fundamentally we know how to run the web service, scale them, manage them, do that at scale. We still have, right, intrinsic capabilities to sort of get you started, get you in the door. But again, these days, developers and customers, they grok like the differences, and they're like, ah, okay, yeah, I want something more complicated. Thanks. It was great using your stuff. I'm now going to move over and, like, again, use something like pipelines. So for stuff that's outside of your core competency or your core business, right, you outsource it. In the real world, right, that's what people do with SaaS services all over the place, right? You know?
Yeah, I pay him money sometimes to help me.
So, okay, so. Yeah.
Not enough. No,
not enough. I'll talk to Lindsay about that. No, it's great to hear about all this stuff because I'm sitting there, like I said, you know, like I mentioned my solar panel backpack. That's because I work from home and I get cabin fever and I don't have a car, you know, so I got a bike. So I go places, but I'm not around a lot of people. And so my core group of people is basically a Discord I've been maintaining. People come in and we kind of rubber duck with each other and like, help, I need help, you know, and, you know, go through stuff like that. But I've also not really talked to people that are doing business like that. And the way you're describing processes and things, it's interesting because you guys are a huge enterprise and I'm a person. And trying to navigate the same issues. And that's one thing I guess I've been trying to put together for a while is like I'm going on this journey of being a programmer and building a service. And millions of people have done this before me. And so this is why I love doing shows like this because I'm talking to you and you've been down that road, you know?
Yeah.
So that's basically like I'm actually a really introverted person, and Rocco always laughs when I said that because I tweet people and just say like, hey, do you want to get on a video call and have a coffee and just talk? And I've never met them, you know. But I've made a lot of connections and learned a lot about business, about programming, about being a person, you know, from people like that.
Yeah. I mean, like I said earlier, definitely it's, you know, knowing what it is that's incredibly important to you, the thing that you're doing, whether it's business life, business value, or in your personal life. And then for other things, not trying to do everything yourself, right? Again, maybe outsource isn't always necessarily the right word, but again, reaching out, learning from others, letting folks who know how to do other things sort of take care of certain problems that they're experts at. Because I mean, at the end of the day, if I come back to what we do in Azure, it's like, I'm lucky enough to be this leaf node service that does all these incredible things. There's no way in heck I'd accomplish that without this huge, and I mean huge, supporting infrastructure that I end up having the luck to stand on top of, right? And the thing is, there's a lot of folks who've done all that foundational work, right? They'll never come to a conference like this. They'll never actually get to meet a lot of folks. And yet without them, like, there's no cloud.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah.
So
I guess the other question I like to ask, and we kind of started talking about this before the show, but I like to ask people like how they even got into technology, how they got started, how did you get introduced to computers, you know, what led you down the path?
Yeah, which is, you know, what'll be interesting is as you progress through, right, your career like 10, 15 years from now, hearing what people say, just because I'm thinking, right, the kids growing up right now, right, on the plus side, they grow up with this incredible array of technology. They have no idea, like, you have no idea what life was like when you didn't have a smartphone, right? To them, it's just like, yeah, sure, right? It's just there. So, yeah, I mean, I obviously remember a life with, what was it? My first networking-related thingy was CompuServe at 300 baud. And remember how happy I was when, like, for a Christmas present, I got, like, a 2400 baud card to plug into my old IBM PC. And that was, like, rocking. But I also remember the prices. Right, on CompuServe, it was like astronomically expensive if you used the super high speed 2400 dial up. So, man, yeah, I remember those days. But in terms of like learning stuff, admittedly, it was my parents who were like, I have no idea why they realized it, but probably when I was in lower school, they're like, you know something, you're going to start learning, you know, what computers are. And of course, I'm just like, whatever, la, 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 kid, yeah, sure, fine, sure, yeah, whatever. Luckily, I took to that and really enjoyed it. This was what I was joking about earlier. My first formal coding class was at a local college campus, learning how to write BASIC on a UNIVAC, of all things. And so there I am, like this little kid, and you're going into this, what back then was, it was a college computing center. I don't know, do they even have computing centers anymore? Computing centers
computer,
on college?
Computer labs.
A computer lab, yeah. That's the closest you get. So I'm the, you know, and it was, again, it was for kids. So we're all these little kids, has this humongous, at least back then to a kid, these humongous doors, you know, it's like a vault opening up. Dun, da, da, and now thou shalt enter the compute center. And it has all these tiered, you know, seats where you sit down. And, of course, back then, the amazing thing is they still had a few teletypes that we were using initially because apparently it was cheaper to use that in terms of the compute credits off the mainframe than it was to use the terminals that actually had like a big fat cathode ray tube. But at the very least, back then, the paper, whatever the paper punch stuff, those were at least, they were already obsolete. They had like two down on the floor in the corner. So that was already sort of passe. I can say that other than learning a couple of basic control constructs, what I mainly learned how to do was how to play Text Adventure really well, because we kept on cadging compute credits on the mainframe off the TA. And so, you know, you're like, okay, I gave you kids another $50 of, you know, whatever, of mainframe credits. So we're like, okay, yeah, go left, go right, go north. So that was literally my introduction to it. But then again, I was lucky I was in schools that also had, we jokingly called them trash 80s, but right, the TRS 80s, where we did actually learn how to go out and write, you know, again, at least like basic code in BASIC. And then I was lucky enough to be able to get myself, my brother getting an IBM PC. And then at that point, we're, you know, screwing around at home writing code. And then also at the same time playing Text Adventure, because of course, right? Yeah. And then really probably what did it was a combination of that, right? The schooling, having being able to play around the computer. And then again, probably not surprisingly for a lot of kids also, you know, having these super primitive games and being like, how the heck are these things even built? Like, ooh, it can actually draw like a colored square. That's fascinating. I want to know how to do that.
So, yeah, games are always, it seems to be like a really good entry point into just development in general. I mean, I started with like, they taught us Logo in school, right? The little turtle drawing pictures. And I was like, oh, it's cool to be able to see
stuff.
Yeah,
that was, I was thinking about that. That's like the little, because there was one camp I was in where they had like these little robot turtles, right? And they, with these cables, they're all going back to these Apple IIs. And back then it was like, we said, okay, we're going to go play Logo football, which of course is sort of silly because you have no idea what anyone's doing. You stick flags on, okay, you got the football, you got the football. And then all these random little logos are zooming all over the floor, crashing into each other. So yeah, that was another way of learning just like, you know, what you can do with a computer. So yeah, that was super early days. And then just from there, I mean, right, once you're in high school, then at that point things were rolling along that, yeah, there's actually computer courses. And then, hey, you can actually go take that in college. And, oh, it turns out you can actually get a job doing this stuff.
Right.
So
that's cool. And you've been at Microsoft for, I think you said, too long?
Yeah, I've been at Microsoft for too long. At this point, I think it's more than 20 years. So, you know, again, right, I started right around the dot-com era. So that was back when like, oh, hey, there's this web development thing. And like, apparently I figured out how to go do web development on, nothing earth shattering, but like classic ASP pages. I actually started out of all things working at Microsoft doing, database development for some of the back ends of what was back then Expedia, when it was actually part of Microsoft, not actually a spinoff. So I remember doing a lot of database development again with a bunch of other folks on that. And that's actually also was my intro to Microsoft. It's like, wow, this is pretty crazy, but pretty cool. And then again, right, just the web development, obviously, because that was actually the team when I joined it was at a point where they're like, hey, we were originally going to develop this product called Expedia, and it was going to be another one of those things that comes on a CD, right? This was back when Microsoft had these, like, I don't know, Encarta on a CD, right? So I don't know how you're going to do a travel app on a CD, but apparently that was the original plan. But then this team was like, there's this internet thing. Let's go put it on the internet. And so, again, I was very lucky to be able to be part of that team, to be working on their databases and just seeing, like, in essence, all of them built this e-commerce site, go book travel. And the funny thing is I still book travel right, on Expedia to this day. Ironically, in many cases, still using my credentials that I established all the way back when, you know, I was, you know, one of the folks working on that team. So that's pretty cool just to have, like, grown up with it and been like, oh, wow, right? And so for me, it was like, okay, obviously, like, you can do something on this internet thing, right? This is, like, where things are going to. And so, again, that sort of informed what I did going forward from that point.
Talk about your long-term data retention.
Yeah, that's, you know, these days, right, it'll be like this recording. It'll end up on a laser-etched disc, and again, there'll be some alien from Mars, like a millennia from now, going, what's this?
Well, they were showing the
exactly.
The crazy thing at the keynote.
Yeah, with the laser etching of the recording of what?
Glass. It was Superman.
Yeah, Superman.
Yeah,
exactly.
Etched on glass. That was cool.
Three-dimensional etching in glass. They burned it, they boiled it, they baked it, they stomped on it,
It was on quartz, I think, right? Some kind of quartz glass so that you can, it's like indestructible. Yeah, so that's pretty amazing. Yeah.
That's really, I didn't know actually that Expedia had started that way. I had no clue.
Yeah, I mean, this was one of these things where back then that general division was doing all kinds of wacky, cracky things. And then it's actually good they spun it off because, right, I mean, you look at Microsoft, it's probably not the right place long term to have a an online booking capability for hotels, airfares, and everything else under the sun. But yeah, it started there just by accident because they had that division that was more around entertainment and information and stuff like that.
Sure.
And then again, I'd already been long out of that team when they eventually went ahead and spun it off and into its own separate entity. So
I think my introduction to Microsoft was probably like the Age of Empire games and things like that.
Oh, hell yeah.
I think it was Ensemble Studios or something.
Yep.
Yeah. I would go and visit family, and my grandpa would get up super early in the morning, and he would smoke a cigarette, drink coffee, and play Age of Empires. And so I would sit there and watch him, you know?
Okay.
Yeah. So that was that was my introduction to Microsoft, really, was like through games, you know?
Yeah.
I remember booting up the modem and throwing a blanket over it so it wouldn't wake my parents up.
Ah. Oh, gosh, yeah. That is, but I mean, you bring up a good point, which is I know there have been, and again, it's not that I'm privy to them, but I always see arguments over, like, why does Microsoft have this entertainment division? Why do you do Xbox? Yeah. And yet it's like, thank God we actually have it and didn't get rid of it, because exactly to your point, that is probably the primary entry point for an entire younger cohort of customers of just like, look, you know, it's they may be running an iPad and, you know, they may be running a MacBook. Mm-hmm. But they come home at night and they want to go play something. And it's like, hey, there's actually something that's right there.
That was me. In college, I studied music, and I had my Mac laptop, and I came home every day and I played Halo on an Xbox. Come home sometimes to strangers in my apartment with multiple TVs. You know, like go into the bathroom and there's a couch in there and people I've never met before. I'm like, all right, have fun. You know. But that was that you describe exactly me, you know. And so fast forward, I don't know how many years it's been now. I look like a child, but yeah, I'm getting up there. But you know, like being around Microsoft, and then I think like coming back here, people would ask me like, "What do you do with Microsoft?" I'm like, "I don't really." You know? So you know, we got invited, and it's been a really cool experience because it's sort of like a reconnection of sorts, I suppose. And the developer stuff has been really cool. Like the tooling has been really awesome to see as well.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's one of the things where, right, again, if you look at Microsoft today, clearly, like the area I work in, that's something where most folks in the outside world would never know it or realize it, right? Yeah. And yet, any service you're consuming that's out there, there's a pretty good probability that the back end of it is powered by something running on us, by a partner and a company that built something that runs on us.
Right.
And so that is definitely, you're right, that there is clearly a change that's been going on now for many, many years where you don't necessarily buy something from Microsoft anymore unless it is like entertainment with an Xbox. Or, again, like if people are going out and buying a Surface or something like that. But more often than not, right? I mean, let's face it, right? The smartphones, they don't run from us, right? It's Android, Apple. But a lot of those back ends, right? That's, for us, a great business, right?
Yeah.
That can run on us. And then, again, I hope we do Xbox until the cows come home because I love it. I think the games are great. And if you actually take a look at, again, if you look at, like, the concept of a service, I mean, myself, I've still got a gaming PC at home with all kinds of random parts that from time to time I throw into it. But for most folks, do they actually have the time or the inclination to figure out how do I mix and match this motherboard with that CPU, with this GPU? Whereas, again, it's like, hey, look, if you actually have a pretty good chunk of hardware. It's all together. The games are qualified to go run on it. I mean, remember the good old days, maybe not so good, where you're like, I played this game, it worked perfectly. I played this game, like, my machine's dying. Like, what, you know? And then you're like, yeah, you should go buy this video card. It's like, really? It's like, I got to buy it. So it's good that that's all, like, sort of normalized in the background for most folks, because they actually have an approachable way to go out and, you know, game, have some kind of connection with Microsoft. Maybe it never goes anywhere. Maybe it does. I mean, that's fine. But definitely, like, the Microsoft store in Bellevue, I mean, there's no doubt about it. I think most of the folks are in there because they're looking at the games or they're playing the Xboxes, which, hey, you know, that just, that's cool.
Well, plus Unity, too. Like, I have some C-sharp experience, and so, like, a friend of ours was like, hey, check out Unity. And I was like, okay, it's weird. Game development's hard. And like, it's not.
Yeah.
It turns out it's free, and, like, and it runs on my Mac, too. Like, that blew me away that how... Like, game development's still hard, but, like, at least I could, like, get my feet wet with it and, like, start to learn the concepts of all the weird stuff and, like, oh, I can actually do this. And that's pretty empowering, too.
Yeah. I mean, it's a similar deal with Minecraft, right? There's a lot of folks who went and played it, and then they mod it, they make use of it. And so, again, it's like, it's regardless of wherever they ultimately land, it's a great way just to learn, like, look, this is how a program, this is how an environment works. As crazy as it sounds, those are effectively miniature distributed environments. And certainly for kids, it's a heck of a lot more interesting to do something like, you know, playing around with Minecraft, seeing how you can mod it versus sitting in a probably comp sci class where you want to fall asleep while someone natters on about, you know, distributed computing concepts.
Sure, yeah.
So when I got my start programming, it was kind of similar to you. I mean, QBasic and then like Logo I mentioned in school. But then somehow my mom got a hold of Visual Basic 5 from someone.
All right.
So that was cool because you had the drag and drop forms and like I could actually design things that you can actually little click on. I would write like little prank apps where like randomly run in the background, then a message box would pop up. And as you try to click it, like move around the screen, that kind of stuff. Right. And then VB6, and then that was .NET 1.0 at that point. Yep. And so I had to make the transition to, wait, what's object-oriented programming? Like, why, I have to instantiate my forms? Like, what is this? And I was still not into web dev at this point, really. I did some cold fusion at my like summer job. But what was I trying to say?
It's still out there, cold fusion. It's still kicking
around. I know. It lives on. It's kind of a zombie at this point. But when I first started getting into web apps, I wrote an ASP.NET app for my school. It was like a homework manager where teachers could post their assignments and then, you know, attachments and stuff, and they could log in and do the whole thing. But I didn't, first of all, the only thing I knew was like XML, because like that's the whole thing with .NET 1.0 is XML and web services, right?
Yes.
And SOAP and all that. So I learned XML, I learned XSL transformations and XPath and all that stuff. And so basically I built an ASP.NET app 1.0 that every view was an XSL transformation, every page. And then the database, I didn't know what SQL was, right? So I was like, oh, I'll just store it in XML. So every time you made a change,
it would
the file into memory, update it, and then dump it back out to the thing.
And then the solution there was to get an XML database.
Some kind of like MongoDB for XML.
Oh, no.
That must exist, right?
That's why, yeah. We jest, but yeah, it's out there. Luckily, we've moved to something that has just enough structure, aka JSON, that makes a lot more sense just to throw into a database.
But that was my start with it, and it was like, looking back on now, it's hilarious, you know, not even knowing SQL or anything, but it worked, and you know, it was still pretty cool to be able to do that.
My intro to the web was an Angel Fire page that had Dragon Ball Z animated GIFs.
All right, so, rocking. Yeah,
I wouldn't make a web app for a very long time after that. I came into programming by I was making WordPress themes. I was playing music for a living. I didn't have any money, so I figured it out, you know, and slowly went into programming from there. But very different experiences.
No. Yeah, I mean, WordPress, right, to this day, the reality is, right, even though it started as a blogging platform, it's probably the most popular content management platform to this day. And what's amazing is even with all the different languages out there and everything else, it's still like there is just WordPress left, right, up, and down.
Yeah. So, I was telling Sean a couple weeks ago, I had to manage a WordPress site for my for a club that I'm in. And yeah, it was kind of like, I was like, oh, I have to deal with this. And I kept putting it off. But then when I got down to it, it was like, okay, every web host provider supports it.
Exactly.
So I just created a thing with them, imported the database, dragged the WP content, whatever, folder over, and you know what? it just worked. It's like, it's stupid. Like, where are my dependencies? Where's the code? Like, I don't even understand. What version am I even running? Doesn't matter. It just runs.
So we had a strategy yesterday of sitting next to an outlet. It's like, if you want to meet people at a conference, just sit next to the power, you know?
Yes.
And people will come and talk to you. And that's, I'd never thought about this before, but we're talking to people, and this guy was telling us how he works for a hotel, and he basically has teams of engineers. And we were just talking about how does the technology advance, right? So you have Angular now, and you have a few developers that are building stuff in React. Like, what now? So you have two platforms to support. What does that even look like? So you've said you've been working on these services for a while. How do you even make those decisions? Like, oh, here's a new thing. At what point is it worth the money to actually adopt a new platform or technology?
Yeah, I mean, for us, so a couple of things is because, again, effectively, both us and a lot of Azure is about running back-end services. We do have the luxury that typically moves at a more graduated pace.
Right.
The upside and the downside of client-side development is that can mutate at light speed.
Yeah.
Right? So, but if I use that as an example, that's a perfect case where it's like, okay, my service is a general purpose service, serverless, right? Was something where a few years ago we're like, okay, great, AWS got Lambda, I guess we should go, do something like that. And there were a group of folks who went off and did that. But nowadays, that's where it dovetails very nicely with case in point, Angular, React, you name it. Because like, hey, there's actually a more natural back end to go out and plug those things together. But I mean, if you look at the general memes, right, the general trends, the reality is there's always going to be some kind of API, some kind of presentation tier, whatever it's written in, that's up in the cloud. For us, it just boils down to like, okay, are there actually like net new language frameworks that come out of nowhere? And for us, that is part of our evolution, right? Which is, from early on, we had pretty good support for PHP and Node, not so great for Python, right? We've done a lot of investments, especially on the Linux side for our service, to actually have good Python support, better Node support, good PHP support, and that's still something, right, for us, that's sort of the heavy-duty investments going forward.
Right.
So, and then if you look at things, though, at a lower level, they're obviously the big bets where, like I was joking earlier, oh, is it relational or is it non-relational? Well, at this point, who cares? If you want to do one or the other, knock yourself out. We support both equally well, so, and actually coming to that specific point, that's also sort of our approach on app service, which is, I don't want to be in a position of having to pick a winner or a loser, and I don't want to be in a position of having to go to a customer and say, well, you shouldn't use technology X because I don't support it. I'd rather say, look, there's enough momentum, great, we'll go figure out how to support it, and I'd rather let you, right, the customers, the developers, just pick what you want, and frankly, if it's comfortable and you're successful at it, who cares? Like the perfect example from a minute ago, WordPress. Yeah, it's not a microservice. No, it's not a well-designed, Angular front end. So what? It does what it does. It does it well. There's a lot of people who know how to use it. Like, use it.
Yeah.
Right? And there's nothing to be embarrassed about. Like, it's a good pragmatic solution for a whole host of scenarios.
Well, I think, nothing to be embarrassed about. That's a huge thing, too. Because, like, say, PHP, people like to hate it. JavaScript, people like to hate it. But if it works and it works. And I think a lot of what you talked about earlier, where you're talking about building the interfaces for people to use. If you can build this well and they can use it, then you're good to go. You don't have to be the one to tell them how they can implement their stuff.
Yep.
And so I've been talking about this now for 6 episodes, so I should probably write a blog post or something. But I've been reading this article about application layering, and specifically it's talking about Elixir because we both use Elixir for our jobs. But I started thinking about it in the sense of, so I came into app development through front end, and so now I'm translating what I'm learning from the back end back into my front end stuff. So thinking about application layering, like yesterday I was thinking about so our app, we have an API, it's Elixir, and we have a front end, which is powered by Express and Vue. And so I was like, okay, what are the layers of my front end? So there's like the data fetching portion, so you might have an API service, and then you have your sort of global store like Vuex or Redux or something. And right now they're kind of like mingled together. So like your actions that you dispatch might make an API request, but maybe they should be split into layers.
Right.
And then you have your presentation layer, like you said, and then your maybe like
controller layer.
So like say I need to build a form. Well, if I have 12 forms, I can go in and write the markup for 12 forms 12 times. Or I could write a transformation layer where I can give it a JSON object and have it generate a form.
Right.
So I feel like that's kind of where I'm starting to level up in my journey. Is like, oh, it's just layers, and you just have to be smart about where you put the layers and how they talk to each other. If you get that right, then you can grow a thing for as long as you need to, and it works. I really wish I would have known that, you know, but that's the really, I think, the cool part about coming to a conference like this, because I didn't know what to expect. Mm-hmm. Initially, I wasn't even sure if we would come because we weren't Microsoft customers or anything, you know, but I've got a lot of value out of talking with people like you, where you just drop something casually in a conversation and then a light bulb goes off in my head and I'm like, oh, that makes so much sense.
Cool.
You know?
Yeah. Well, yeah. To the point about like layering loosely connected services, again, it's one of these things where, you know, you read about it in a book, you hear about it in a presentation, but it's a completely different experience to actually live it and sort of have that oh, duh moment, like, oh, you know something? Without us realizing it, we backed into actually doing the right thing. And now that I've done it, it's sort of like, oh, this is actually why it matters. And then to your point, right, it's interesting on the layering. It's, you know, for us, we have an approach where sometimes we'll put something together quick and dirty to see if it hangs together. It's not worth stressing over, have you done it in an architecturally correct form? It's just like, just try it. Does it work? And then, look, if it takes off, fine. Walk into it with eyes wide open, realizing, look, there may be parts of what you've invested in that, yeah, you're going to end up rewriting from scratch. And again, it's okay, because sometimes you don't have the time and the resources to build everything perfectly on day one. You just got to sort of see what flies, what works, what doesn't.
It's the story of our lives, I think.
Yeah, well, we just appreciate you talking with us, spending time with us, you know.
Thank you for having me out. This was good.
So we always ask a few more questions too. So is there anything specifically you want to shout out, something you're interested in, you want people to know about?
Well, I mean, stating the obvious, right, Azure App Service, right, I've been with it, again, been very lucky to be with it from what I joke is day negative one. in essence, again, by accident, not by original intent back then, myself and a lot of other folks on it have been lucky enough to literally see what's sort of like a startup grow from nothing into what it is today inside of Azure. So, you know, if you're using it, thank you. I appreciate it. If you haven't, you know, go out there, try it out. You can absolutely kick the tires for free. It doesn't cost any money. And, you know, keep an eye on us, because certainly if you think about it, we're a service. We started out effectively being IaaS in the cloud. And now literally in, you know, less than 24 hours, I'm going to be spending time demoing on stage, running, you know, deploying Node and Python apps onto Linux on our service, which gives you an idea of how much we've grown and how much more breadth we sort of built into the product.
Yeah, I mean, I'm definitely... We've been spending a lot of time playing with VS Code Online because
it seems like a
good fit for us. And like, I'm gonna honestly take a look at it and just see what it takes to like just get our stuff up and running, because the stuff we do is pretty straightforward. It's not that complicated. It seems like a very well supported use case. So you know, I'm just curious. You know, it's nice to have the options.
Yeah, you know, I mean, that you actually bring up a great thing there. I mean, with VS Code Online, it's the old thing of like, I remember once upon a time to set up your dev environment. You're like, here's your 15 page doc.
Spend the next week. We still do that. Yeah, we still do that.
Right.
Yeah.
And so again, I mean, they're trying to get it to the point of like, okay, you know, maybe one person figures it out, and then just like bang, like just go. Get rid of these speed bumps where you get up in the morning like, oh man, I got to drag through all of this just to get started. It's like, no, just like you're ready to go.
Yeah.
So I love it.
So if you're on this since day negative one, is that like an overflow error? So you're actually really, you're going till day 8 billion?
Yeah. You know, that was one of those things where like a lot of us were just like, is this thing going to fly? But I got to tell you, it was at the time it sounded like super interesting, like way more interesting than worrying about like cranking out the next version of something. And so... That was why a lot of us, myself included, took the leap. And I'm like, wow, I've been so happy with how it's turned out.
Yeah. Well, again, thanks for talking with us.
Yeah, this was great. Thanks, guys.
Love it. Appreciate it. Anywhere people can reach you online, even kind of online presence or a blog or Twitter or any of that stuff?
I admit I myself do not have an online Twitter handle or blog, so I'm one of those sort of faceless individuals lurking within the bowels of Azure.
It made it difficult to prepare for this interview. I'll say that.
there we go. My plans for keeping my online presence clean. Incredibly useful.
We watched Channel 9 videos from 2013.
Yes. Yep. Well, there you go. You can watch some of my old Ignite and Build videos.
Yeah.
There you go. So.
Cool.
Great.
Well, all right. Cool. Thank you for having me on, guys. This was great.
It's been wonderful. Thanks.
Thank you again to Blumador for sponsoring this week. Take your flat metrics and logs and turn them into deep dimensional analysis with the industry's leading monitoring integration as a service. Head on over to Blumador.com/compute for a $200 credit towards Google Cloud Platform, and take advantage of Blumador's integration with Google Stackdriver.